Revelation chapter 18. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." Then I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart, she boasts, 'I sit as queen. I am not a widow, and I will never mourn.' Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her: death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, 'Woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power, in one hour your doom has come.' The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood, and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and human bodies and souls. They will say, 'The fruit you longed for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered.' The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, 'Woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. In one hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea, will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, 'Was there ever a city like this great city?' They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, 'Woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In one hour she has been brought to ruin.' Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you." Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No workman of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's great men. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of prophets and of the saints and of all who have been killed on the earth. The word of the Lord.
Well, I hope that you've got a great Thanksgiving planned. It's a wonderful holiday of the year, isn't it? It seems like Christmas has been co-opted by lots of different things. But Thanksgiving remains that time when we can come together and give thanks to God for the way God has blessed us. So I hope that you will be having a very safe trips, that you'll be with your family, with your loved ones, and that it will be a wonderful week for you. I want to remind you that next Sunday, because it is a holiday weekend, we won't have our typical classes at 9. We'll be having a special time, though, of fellowship in our fellowship hall at 9. One of our adult classes is bringing goodies for us, so come at 9, enjoy that time. I think probably the teenagers will grab a snack and head downstairs away from us, and our kids have classes going on at 9 as well. So there'll be something happening, but gather together there and enjoy that time of fellowship with each other and extend your time of thankfulness to your church family. How many of you have seen the TV show Breaking Bad? All right, tell me now. Yeah, a lot of you have seen Breaking Bad. I don't know. A lot of people have gotten addicted to Breaking Bad, either watching it when it was first airing or going back and seeing it on Netflix. And Breaking Bad, for those of you who haven't seen it, is the story of a mild-mannered chemistry teacher named Walter White, who finds out that he gets a terminal diagnosis and decides that he needs to provide for his family, so he starts cooking meth. And the show is this kind of a just watching the slow turn in his life towards just a winding down of this man's life. And it seems that the show's creator had kind of bigger picture in mind all the time, a bigger story that he was trying to tell. He said that if there's a larger lesson to Breaking Bad, it's that actions have consequences. And he also said this, he said that I feel some sort of need for biblical atonement. I feel a need for justice or something like it. In one scene in Breaking Bad, Walt's young accomplice Jesse commits a murder for the first time. And then he goes to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and he shares at the meeting this thinly veiled account of what he's just done, kind of trying to find some kind of peace or resolution. And after he shares this, the group leader says, "Well, now, we're not here to sit in judgment over you." And Jesse explodes. And he says, "Why not? Why not? If you just do stuff and nothing happens, then what does it all mean? What's the point? So you're saying that no matter what I do, hooray for me, because I'm a great guy, that somehow it's just all good." Judgment is a pretty negative word in our day. Something that I hear around my house, especially since Allie's gotten home, is, "Don't judge me." That's kind of a catchphrase these days. But in the Bible, God's judgment is something to be looked forward to. It's something to be celebrated. The thought of God's coming judgment is supposed to make people shout and trees clap their hands. That's how glorious and wonderful it's supposed to be. And you can imagine in a world where people are systematically oppressed, where the threat of violence is always looming over your head, and the powerful can take whatever they want and whatever you have. In a world like that, then the thought that someday there might come a time when the poor and the weak will be given justice would be good news, wouldn't it? Be great news. The question I've been asking myself as I've been reading Revelation here lately is, are our lives too comfortably lined up with the ways of this world to appreciate a message of judgment? Earlier in the book, John pictured this woman who was clothed with the sun. You remember us talking about that? And she was standing on the moon, and she had a crown of 12 stars. And she gives birth to what is obviously the Christ, and then becomes another image of the mother of the church. And she is kind of the image of the church. And she's pursued by this beast, and you know, the evil is pursuing the church. But now in chapter 17, John sees another vision. It's another woman. She's quite a contrast to that earlier woman he saw. This woman in chapter 17 is pictured as an expensive prostitute. She's all decked out in gold. She has all costly jewelry on. And she's riding on a beast, the same beast, the one with the seven heads and the 10 horns that was pursuing the woman earlier in the book. And she holds in her hand a cup, and she's drunk from the cup that she holds. But the cup doesn't hold wine. It holds all kinds of atrocities, the blood of the saints, the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. And on her head is like a billboard for all of her activities. Written across it is Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And John calls this name a mystery. And I think he calls it a mystery because he intends for it to carry multiple meanings. Babylon, going all the way back to the city of Babel in Genesis, Babylon is the image of humanity united against God. The Jews thought of many cities and nations as Babylon. Babylon was Babylon, but Persia was Babylon too. And the city of Nineveh was Babylon, and Greece was Babylon, and even in some places Jerusalem is compared to Babylon. Babylon is a flexible term for any city or nation in opposition to God. And there in chapter 17, there are also multiple meanings attached to the way this woman and what she's riding on. First, it says she's seated on a beast, and that's the way of connecting us and recognizing that these people are connected to the evil that undergirds and is in opposition to God in our world. Then it says that she's seated on many waters. And that's a way of kind of saying, and specifically he says it in verse 15, that her power extends over the waters to other countries, to other nations and other people. And then later on he says that she's seated on seven hills. So it's kind of this, you see this complexity of this image. She's seated on a beast and on waters and on seven hills. That's not to be made sense of in some kind of literal way. It's to be made sense of in understanding the deep symbols there. Now, everybody knew that the reference to the seven hills was a reference to Rome. Rome was famous for its seven hills. It was the city on seven hills. Pictured on many of its coins were seven hills. Everybody knew what he was talking about when he talked about Babylon being seated on seven hills. But this is an image not just of the city of Rome, but of the empire of Rome and even of the character of that empire. And we've talked about it before, and you think about it again. If I had you to imagine a woman standing, you know, dressed in a toga, standing on water with a crown on her head and holding up a torch, and she's got some kind of tablet in her, you've got a picture in your mind. So you might have a picture of New York City. But you would also have a picture perhaps of America, you know, a greater thing, but also maybe of the character or the ethic that undergirds that, perhaps a welcoming of people from other shores to our shores. So it's kind of that image has many different meanings. I want to remind you that John isn't trying to fool anybody with this image. The idea that he's trying to slip something past the Roman censors, that's not why he uses this kind of symbolic language. He's layering these meanings and using this kind of, real imagination and to magnify his message so that we kind of see a stark contrast in the world around us. Even when Revelation starts to compare the heads and the horns to kings and kingdoms, he's really probably not trying to draw some kind of specific timeline, because you can start to line up these Roman emperors, and they've tried it in many different ways with the way this is arranged, and none of it works historically, okay? But if we read it consistently with the way we've been reading it in here week after week, this image of seven horns or seven heads and 10 horns, then you recognize that he's not just talking, he's not trying to draw a timeline, he's trying to show us something about the nature of something. And it's the nature of this beast. And the nature of this beast is characterized by this seven and by this 10. Those terms meaning completion or fullness. And this is about now the fullness of evil in the world. How fully Babylon can embody evil. How completely he's drawing a picture for us of the essence or the nature of evil. So you take it all together, and this message is supposed to make you react from the gut, to make you feel revulsion when you think about it. You can ride on the beast, and just as sure as the world, the beast is going to turn on you. Birds fly, fish swim, and evil consumes its own. You live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. You reap what you sow. Babylon has fallen. Babylon will always fall. Isn't that a more powerful message? And this woman is not the last of her kind either. You see, she's the mother of more Babylons. So it's like John is saying, you watch out, because you too might find yourself waking up one day in Babylon. The trick is to come out. How do I come out of Babylon? And how would you know a Babylon if you saw one? It probably is not going to be advertising itself with a big billboard on its head, right? And I think as we read chapter 18, maybe we can find some of the ways that Babylon is marked, some of the marks of Babylon. I see six of them here. Maybe you'll see more. One, I see materialism. I was just talking about the way, Christmas has been co-opted. I mean, when we think of Christmas today, we initially have, instinctively start to think about things rather than the coming of Christ. What's the world done to us there? Materialism, the worship of products, the worship of production, the search for happiness in stuff. Whatever helps you make the most money or accumulate the most possessions becomes the driving force of your society. It becomes truth. The second mark, seeking power over others. Babylon wants to rule. Babylon says, I'm a queen. I can't mourn. How can I be a widow? And she makes kings. And merchants find that cooperating with her brings them great power and the ability to have control over other people. A third mark, a self-centered sensuality, where the goodness of our physical bodies, the goodness of physicality, including sex, is exchanged for the self-centered pursuit of pleasure at whatever cost. Human beings being valued for only their physical beauty, the ability they have to titillate the opposite sex. A fourth mark, violence. She has a cup full of blood. The willingness to harm others to get what we want, to eliminate those who threaten or oppose us. The idea that our security is found somehow in weapons. This particular Babylon was willing to systematically eliminate its opposition, including Christians. Why are we surprised when Babylons today try to do the same? A fifth mark, injustice. Verse 13 begins this whole list of goods that are being bought and sold by Rome. But there it ends very purposely. The final straw, the final place it always goes if you go down this road, this materialistic approach to life, is the exchange and ownership of the bodies of human beings. Rome was built on slavery, conquering and then exchanging, buying and selling people. Was big business for them. And many societies have used slaves to accumulate wealth. You travel through Europe and you see all those gigantic fine castles. Many of them were produced with forced labor. Go around Atlanta or some other place in the South, see those big, beautiful antebellum homes, and think about the lives of the people that were used up to accumulate that wealth. And it's not just that it was a problem in the distant past and it has nothing to do with us today. If you're interested in it, read the book Slavery by Another Name, or watch the documentary. It's been on TV here on PBS. It describes a system where up until World War II in the South, a number of industrialists, corporations, and large farmers used a system where they would lease convict labor generated by crooked small town sheriffs and lawyers and justices of the peace, and basically enslave people, and they built fortunes off of this. And the book traces those things back, and that's within the lifetime of people living today. And you read the book or watch the documentary, you can't walk around Atlanta and see some of the names of the corporations or the names of the buildings and really think about them the same way. Bricks made by people who were basically enslaved, and they're still standing there. Under the guise of the rightness of getting what we deserve, there's this tendency, it seems, in evil to use other people as tools. Human beings become bodies. Evil doesn't see faces. And be wary of anybody who tells you that that's just a phenomenon from the past. Because you've got to dehumanize another person before you're willing to do evil to them. The number tattooed on the arm of a Jew in a death camp. The pornographic image of a woman on the internet. Or the reduction to a number on a spreadsheet in some corporate boardroom or political office of a person, and the decisions made about that person are all part of the same process. Taking away the true humanity, failing to look at the face. I heard on the news this week that in 2015 in the United States, they're predicting that one out of every 30 children in this country will be homeless at some point during the year. That's phenomenal. And there are a lot of reasons people are poor. But I can't think of one where a child should be responsible for it. And there are honest differences of opinion on how to create a society where children aren't homeless. But any way of thinking about that fails to see the faces of those children where they just become a number. It fails to take into account their humanity. That's not justice. Have you noticed that what usually turns a person into a crusader for justice on any particular issue is a personal encounter with somebody? Somebody who's a victim. Here Brandon was showing us those slides. And it's one thing to hear about Georgia Agape, isn't it? But it's another thing to see the faces of Adrian and Grant and Maria. Another thing to see their faces, isn't it? How can you see their face and not care? How can you see their face and take away their humanity and place this over in some other place in your life and say, it's not my problem? Now, that's just one example, you know, of how our lives are intertwined with justice in our society. We cannot ignore the faces, the humanity of other people. And I think that leads us to one more mark of Babylon: deception. Babylon will blind you to whatever it doesn't want you to see. It will tell you anything that you want to hear. Babylon has no qualms about lying. The only thing Babylon wants is to have you go along with the program. Don't rock the boat. If the truth causes Babylon trouble, the truth can easily be left out. Everything about Babylon is a lie. We've been reading this book. You see the parody of evil, the way evil parodies the truth, parodies what is good, parodies what is God. And Babylon is not just a city. Babylon's not just a nation or a culture. Babylon can be what you find rising up in your own heart, the kingdom that you set up there as well, independently of God. Our culture probably values independence more than any other thing. But when you get into bed with Babylon, you want to do anything but take responsibility for it. You point fingers at everybody else. I was read once in Johnny Cash's autobiography. Johnny Cash fan, okay. And he was telling about a time that he, back in the 90s, when he played at a function in D.C., and a lot of people from the White House were there, and Bill Clinton was there. This was during his presidency, and it was right after the Monica Lewinsky affair, and Cash played his song, The Beast in Me. I don't know if you know that song, The Beast in Me. Let me read some of the lyrics to you. The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day, and by night rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me has had to learn to live with pain and how to shelter from the rain, and in the twinkling of an eye might have to be restrained. God help the beast in me. Sometimes it tries to kid me that it's just a teddy bear, and even somehow manage to vanish in thin air. And that's when I must beware of the beast in me that everybody knows. They've seen him out dressed in my clothes. God help the beast in me. Now you can imagine, some of the folks in the White House didn't like too much him singing that song there at that time. And they thought, you know, he was pointing fingers. But as he says in the book, and if you know Cash, or, you know, he was not pointing fingers at somebody else. He was saying, I've lived this. This is my story. There's a beast in me, and that's the reality. And until we all face that, whether you are a country music singer or a president or a preacher or whoever, until you face that beast lurks there as well. There's no way to get rid of evil. There's no way to come out of Babylon. It's only when you reject deception, and admit where you're compromised with evil, that you can come out of Babylon. And ultimately, that's not going to happen by your own or my own power. That's true, but it's just as true that it won't happen against your own or my own will. If we want to stay in Babylon, we can. God won't force you to do what's best for you. God will let you remain in Babylon. And that means also, from all appearances at least, although I pray for a miracle, that God will let us suffer the consequences, judgment. But we can come out of it. That is the ultimate message of this book. You can come out of Babylon, whether Babylon comes riding into your life on the back of a culture or a nation or a group of friends, or you find it coming from within your own heart, you can come out of it. You can reject the way of evil and choose the way of Christ, the way of the Lamb. This revelation reminds us we are made for better things. I'd like to talk with you more about that. And if you'd like to learn more about that, if you're visiting with us today or you have been thinking about this and you've been thinking about following Christ in your life, perhaps it's to make a public confession of your desire to follow Christ in your life, to be baptized, to show everyone that you are stepping onto the side of the Lamb. Or if it's to perhaps come for and ask for prayers from this congregation because of a loss or a struggle that you're having, or perhaps it's to confess your sin. We need to come out of Babylon. Let's stand, let's sing.